I'm Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. There are several developments in the now five-day-long conflict between Russia and Georgia. Russian President Dmitry Medvedev says Russia will stop its military action in Georgia, and he agreed to begin international talks on the future of Georgia's breakaway provinces. That plan was brokered in Moscow today with French President Nicolas Sarkozy, who's taking the proposal to Georgian President Mikhail Saakashvili. The White House today rejected a Russian call for Saakashvili to step down, and there are reports that despite the Russian pledge, the fighting continues. This started last week when Georgia tried to regain control of the breakaway Republic of South Ossetia, which led Russia to send troops first into South Ossetia and then into Georgia proper. We're going to hear from several people on this story today, but first we go to the Georgian capital, Tbilisi. That's where Christian Science Monitor correspondent Paul Rimple has lived for the past 7 years. And Paul, what's the mood of people in Tbilisi today?
On one hand, people are rallying behind the president because there's a common enemy, which is Russia. On the other hand, there's a lot of people here in Tbilisi who are frightened. They don't know what's going on. They've been getting so many false reports. There's fear that Russia could enter Tbilisi and, start bombing, start shooting. As irrational as it may sound, there's basis for their fear. This kind of mentality goes back to the Soviet massacre that occurred in Tbilisi back in April of 1989, when Soviet troops, they broke up a Tbilisi demonstration and killed about 20 people, injured hundreds. And so even though there's been this Russian ceasefire, there's still reports of bombings going on, and, nobody trusts Russia.
But in Tbilisi, it's calm.
In Tbilisi, it's calm. I haven't noticed any bombers flying overhead. I noticed them yesterday. But otherwise, it was refreshing to see so many people out on Rustavi Avenue, on the main boulevard, because for the past few days, the feeling has been so tense. The shops are open. Yesterday, I noticed by the evening, there was a big run on bread. Everybody bought up bread and pasta. Today, there doesn't seem to be such a kind of panic.
What do you think is the likelihood of a ceasefire then? Is it merely words then, if it's difficult for people to even believe that this is possible?
That's kind of like the irony of the Caucasus. Let me put it this way. Russia has announced a ceasefire, and yet these reports are coming in that there's still bombing happening, and whether these reports are true or not, people believe them to be true, and so therefore they don't trust Russia.
And the latest news from Tbilisi anyway today is that it's calm, but there was a rally there today.
Yes, there was a pro-government rally, and most people openly supported Saakashvili. There are also a couple people there that were totally against Saakashvili, yet it was good for them to actually be out on the streets today. I did meet a couple people, though, that weren't there necessarily to back Saakashvili as they were to, in one man's words, to support freedom.
Christian Science Monitor correspondent Paul Rimple, he spoke with us from the Georgian capital, Tbilisi. Thanks, Paul.
Thank you, Deborah.
We turn now to Vasyl Sigaridze. He's Georgia's ambassador to the U.S. And ambassador, what do you think Russia's been trying to accomplish in the 5 days of this conflict?
What they are trying to do, they are trying to send a very powerful signal to the free world to show that the Russian power is back, and they want them to have some kind of rights over certain territories. And they're generally trying to do is they are trying to change the entire international order.
Russia says that Georgia was the aggressor here for moving into South Ossetia in the first place last week. Why did Georgia decide to do that?
Russia has been trying to intensify its provocations on this direction starting from April this year, unfortunately. We have to admit, unfortunately, that there were a number of provocations, a huge number of provocations starting from April this year. Throughout what Georgian forces did, they responded on the heavy shelling of Georgian villages. It's a case is very simple here, and we don't have to over-sophisticate it. They entered with overwhelming military force into the sovereign Georgian territory. They occupy Georgia's territory even now. and they occupy even several cities beyond conflict zones, and they are blockading Georgian seaports. They've been targeting Georgia's civilian infrastructure, they've been targeting Georgia's economic infrastructure. It's a terrible thing. We have to call a spade a spade.
What do you think this conflict in Georgia means to the long-term stability of the region?
I think that that seriously undermines the regional stability. I think that other nations also won't feel really safe after all that happened.
What are you hearing from people who are in Georgia? What do you hear from them? What's happening there in terms of the military action that's been taking place over the past couple of days?
Yes, of course, it's terrifying when innocent people were dying, and they bombed several cities and a lot of villages all across the Georgia. But Georgian society stands very united and in face of this aggression. And I am pretty sure that it unites around these ideals, entire society, entire population.
Vasyl Sigurulidze is Georgia's ambassador to the U.S., and he joined us on the line from Washington. For a view from Russia, we now go to Simon Sarajan, who's in Moscow. He's a consultant for Harvard's Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs, and he's currently deputy editor of the Moscow Times, which is an English daily in Russia. And Simon, first of all, many Western media outlets are portraying Russia as the main aggressor in this conflict. What would you say is the view of the average Russian?
For an average Russian who relies so mostly on national television channels, it's Georgia that it's the aggressor, and Russia is merely exercising its right as the peacekeeper, as well as protecting an ethnic minority in the Caucasus.
Can you tell me some of the specifics about what the accusations are against Georgia in South Ossetia?
Russian authorities have accused Georgia of initiating a wide-scale attack on South Ossetia with indiscriminate use of force that, according to Russian authorities, destroyed quite a few number of South Ossetian villages, basically razed to the ground the capital of South Ossetia, Tkhinval, and engaged into ethnic cleansing, including shooting of innocent civilians.
And are there images shown on television of those things actually happening?
Oh, yes. Rather gory images of civilians killed, houses destroyed, Georgian tanks falling. You almost get a feeling that it's a wide-scale aggression that the South Ossetians were helpless to stop, and that only Russia's help could prevent genocide of the South Ossetians.
What about, though, the coverage of the Russians moving into Georgia proper, out of South Ossetia, and the images of Georgian President Mikhail Saakashvili hunkering down under bodyguards while Russian jets fly overhead in gory?
In terms of coverage of the Georgian president, you would always think that Russian channels are not only degrading him, but mocking him. That incident was portrayed as something, as a completely unjustified, nervous breakdown of a president of another country, that there was no real threat. They portrayed it as something that president thought was happening, but was not happening in reality. So his reaction of trying to take cover was completely out of blue and had nothing to do with the reality happening in the town he was visiting.
Do you believe that Russia was justified in sending troops into Georgia like this?
I would say Russia's decision to send troops into South Ossetia would have been justified if it hadn't been followed up by a larger scale and, in many cases, indiscriminate use of force with, facilities bombed all over Georgia, quite far away from the zone of conflict.
Simon Sarajan is deputy editor of the English daily Moscow Times. He spoke with us from Moscow. Thank you, Simon.
You're welcome.
And joining us to talk about some of the long-term implications of this conflict and the role of current Russian Prime Minister and former Russian President Vladimir Putin, we turn to Marshall Goldman, who's just returned from Russia. He's a senior scholar at Harvard University's Davis Center for Russian and Eurasian Studies. His new book is titled Petrostate: Putin, Power, and the New Russia. And Marshall, do you think, as some people have suggested, that Vladimir Putin was looking for any way to get into Georgia to make a statement about Russia's power?
I think he was, and this is a way of trying to reconstitute what used to be the Russian Empire. So it's a small way, and it's also a signal to some of the other former republics who have been showing more and more independence from Russia and trying to link up more with the West, that they'd better be careful or they may end up with the same kind of problems that Georgia has.
It doesn't sound like the new Russia is all that different from the old one, then.
No, but it's the new Russia from what it was in the 1990s, when it seemed to be moving in the direction of more democracy and a much smaller kind of empire.
So essentially, then, this is a message from Russia, you would say, that don't mess with us, basically.
Very much so. And also, this is a sign that it's been explicit in some cases that when the West supported the breakaway of Kosovo from Serbia, that the Russians said, well, you try to hurt our ally, Serbia, we can show you that we can do the same kind of thing in our own backyard. And there's another aspect about it, too, I think, that is sometimes overlooked, and that the Russians are very angry at Georgia for agreeing to the building of a pipeline across Georgia. That pipeline breaks up the Russian monopoly, which has been controlling the flow of oil and gas from Central Asia to Europe. And with that pipeline, the Georgians have been able to break that monopoly, and the Russians are very angry about that. And I have to say, I actually predicted that this was the Georgians would be subject to a lot of pressure from Russia. I mentioned that explicitly in the book because it really interferes with their strong suit, which is their control of oil and gas, not only within Russia, but from Central Asia.
Hmm. So that oil and gas in Georgia, that pipeline anyway, is very significant, you would say, is a big player in all of this.
Very much so, very much so. The Russians have been able to obtain oil and gas from Central Asia, particularly Turkmenistan and Kazakhstan, by paying them a very small price and then selling it at a very high price in Western Europe. And of course, that's a new Russia, too. But the Georgians, by building this pipeline, interfered with that whole operation.
So how much oil are we talking about, would you say?
Well, we're talking about a substantial quantity here, and they're also building some additional pipelines through the Baltic and in the Mediterranean route. But Turkmenistan in particular has very large deposits of natural gas, maybe the third or fourth largest in the world, and they are bottlenecked. They can't get out without going through, as it were, Russia through the old Gazprom pipelines, but now they do have a new outlet that soon will open up through Georgia.
Mm-hmm. So there really are an awful lot of factors here. I mean, there's not it's not a pipeline. It's not Kosovo. It's 20 years or more of history here, really, of what's there's the so-called color revolutions, the U.S. interest in Georgia. I mean, there are a lot of things at play here.
And it's, I think, typified by the statement the governor of St. Petersburg made. She said, yeah, for years people have been telling us what to do, pushing us around. Now we don't have to listen anymore. You know, we're basically back, is what she's saying. And Russia's a big country. It's a proud country. And they resented very much the fact that people were taking them for granted.
Longtime Kremlin watcher Marshall Goldman is talking with us about the situation in Georgia. When we come back, we ask him, how does this conflict affect U.S. relations in that region? We'll be back in a minute. It's Here and Now. We're continuing our coverage of the conflict between Russia and Georgia. Russia has called for an end to military action in Georgia, but it's also called for Georgia's president to resign. We've been speaking with Marshall Goldman. He's senior scholar at Harvard University's Davis Center for Russian and Eurasian Studies. And Marshall, Georgia's a key U.S. ally. The Pentagon retrained the Georgian army, and Georgia was the third largest contributor of troops to Iraq after the U.S. and Britain. So would you say this conflict has been a setback for the United States?
Yes, it is. And it's nothing else. It has to be a significant disappointment for President Bush, who was very close to Prime Minister Putin, President Putin formerly. The two of them had a very close relationship. They did meet just recently in Beijing. But it's also a signal from the Russians that the United States should stay out of Russia's backyard. And they view that as their backyard. They don't really think of Georgia as being all that independent. It was part of the Russian Empire. It was part of the Soviet Empire. And the fact that we had troops, American troops in there training Georgian troops, was all the more a source of concern and anger from the Russians. And so what they're saying, you know, don't just stay out. Just go home. It's kind of a Monroe Doctrine, if you will.
Hmm. And so what options does the U.S. have? Should it just go home, or what do you think should happen here?
Well, see, that's what's so interesting here. Now that Russia is back this way with its energy, there's really not much we can do except say, well, we maybe throw you out of our club, the G8 meeting of industrial nations. But it's very different from what it was during the Cold War. During the Cold War, there was something called MAD, mutually assured destruction. You don't use your nuclear weapons, we won't use ours. If you do, we will. And so nobody used them. Here, there's nothing to balance off the Russians with their oil and gas. And it's a very powerful tool. It's even more powerful in Europe, where the Germans, for example, get over 40% of their natural gas from Russia. So if the Russians threaten to cut off that natural gas, the Germans really have no other alternative, at least in the short run.
So this conflict ultimately will really shape Russia's relationship with the West well into the future, don't you think?
I think it will, except, again, I'm old enough to think that we have short memories, so we'll be angry for a couple of years and say, well, okay, we won't let you into this club, and when we see you, we'll shake our fingers, say, bad boy, bad boy. But then after a while, particularly as the Russians see it, they've got the gas. We're going to have to rely on them for that energy. They're the world's second largest producer of petroleum now, next to Saudi Arabia. And so I think Putin's calculation is, okay, let them stew in their juice. They're going to have to turn to us, and they'll get over their anger shortly because they have no other alternative.
Hmm. You know, we are hearing reports, breaking news reports, really, that Russia's president has agreed to a plan that calls for Russian and Georgian troops to stop fighting and move back to their initial positions out of the breakaway regions of Georgia. Would you say that that's a good move for what's happening here?
Well, I think it is, because I mean, one of my concerns is that the Russians would continue to move their troops all the way to the capital of Georgia, Tbilisi, because there basically was nothing to stop them. The Georgian troops are really far fewer in number, and they don't have the equipment that the Russians can bring to bear. So to the extent that the Russians say, okay, we proved our point, now go about your business, that might be good. But there are still, I hear some calls from the Minister of Foreign Affairs in Russia, Lavrov, for example, that one of the conditions the Russians are demanding is that Saakashvili step down. So there may be some pressure along that lines. I think actually maybe within Georgia itself there will be also some pressure, complaining that Saakashvili led them into this dead end, and he should pay a price for it.
Marshall, I'm wondering if this is in fact, a message to everyone that Russia is back and it's powerful and it's ready to defend itself strongly. What kind of a new Russia are we talking about now that the world is facing and that the U.S. Is going to have a relationship with?
Well, that's a good question, and I hope we live long enough to see it. But it's certainly going to be a Russia that's going to demand a voice in international affairs in a way that it's not been able to do effectively. It also will mean that this will be a much richer country in terms of its holdings of currency, and it will also bring a new prosperity to Russia. I mean, internally, the Russians will, I think, be able to enjoy a standard of living they've never been able to enjoy either in the Tsarist era or the Soviet era. We were just in Russia, and you can begin to sense what is happening. My wife and I and our grandchildren were eating outside in an outdoor restaurant, and what I noticed is that people seemed to be having a good time in a way that was unfamiliar to me in the past. And then we heard an American official in the embassy say that the thing that he's noticed that's different is that the Russians are smiling at each other now, something that was most unusual in the Soviet era. And so I think what the Russians now feel is a new self-confidence economically, self-confidence in this case politically. They managed to change what the Georgians were doing, and who knows how far this will be in terms of its impact on Georgia and on some of the other former republics. So the new Russia, I think, is one that's more self-confident, which could lead to some abuse in the future, particularly if the United States is unable to solve some of our economic and political problems. So we're going to see a new balance of power here in a way that will be quite unusual.
And what about, what do you expect will be the next move from Vladimir Putin?
Well, he's a very cocky guy, and it's going to be hard for him now to sit back and just ignore the limelight. It was very clear in these last few days that he was not going to take a backstage position. He liked being out front, and this will be very interesting to see how he behaves. It doesn't mean that he's going to be applauded when he appears on the world stage, but it does mean that people are going to have to step aside for him and give him the respect that, that he and I think Russia crave.
Marshall Goldman is senior scholar at Harvard University's Davis Center for Russian and Eurasian Studies. His new book is Petrostate: Putin, Power, and the New Russia. Tomorrow on Here and Now, the inside story of Hillary Clinton's failed presidential campaign. Joshua Green of The Atlantic magazine says it was even worse than he imagined. That's tomorrow. Still ahead, we'll have a new online option to protect your business against the vagaries of the weather. It's Here and Now. I'm Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Imagine you have to save the world, but you only have a month. That, on a slightly smaller scale, is the goal of the International Design and Development Seminar held earlier this month at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. 60 participants from around the world, students, healthcare workers, carpenters, farmers, engineers, worked at a frenzied pace to conceive, design, and build devices to help the developing world. Last year's inaugural summit resulted in a low-cost refrigeration system and a device to reduce smoke from cooking fires. This year's projects are equally ambitious. Here and Now's Karen Miller Medson headed to MIT to see the program in action.
We're putting corncob charcoal into the top, the hopper, and then I'm going to turn this crank, and it's going to turn the cylinder, which has a grinding surface on it, and it's going to crush the charcoal.
It's lunchtime when I arrive in what I'm told is the D-Lab, but no one is eating. The cluttered, windowless basement room is a hub of activity. People mill in and out, and three groups of participants in this year's IDDS are bent over their laptops and sketches and prototypes.
I'm Joshua from Zambia.
Bernard Kiria from Tanzania.
Jessica Vechikol from MIT.
Nathan Cook from Art Center College of Design.
Sumit from India.
I see you guys crowded around a table, and there's some kind of metal shavings on the table, and there's a square, well, sort of rectangular box with a crank and something metallic inside that looks like it's going to grind something.
Exactly, yeah.
Can you tell me what it is that your team's working on?
So basically, we're trying to make fuel from agricultural waste, and D-Lab students developed a way to make corn cobs into charcoal. But if you burn this maize charcoal directly, it produces too much carbon monoxide. And then what we're doing is we're turning the corn cob charcoal into charcoal powder so that it could be turned into a briquette.
I think we've been trying out several other methods, but this one looks a bit promising, although we are trying to actually reduce the cost of materials to be used. So we're trying to use simple materials that will make it affordable for the people in the rural areas.
On the other side of the lab, an eclectic group with members from Tibet, Zambia, and Guatemala is designing a machine to make soil building blocks that don't need to be baked or fired. Down the hall, another group sits around a bank of computers designing a handheld medical testing kit for hard-to-reach rural villages.
The goal is really to create something that could be carried in a backpack that would be able to test a village's worth of people.
That's Mark Jeanette from Denver. His group is trying to solve the complex issue of diagnosing illness in remote regions, since it's expensive and impractical to transport blood samples to modern clinics where they can be analyzed.
Part of the problem with current diagnostics is that if they're based on blood samples, blood is very difficult to transport. So what this device would allow the lab technician to do would be to go out to a village collect blood, perform this process on this blood immediately to get DNA suspended in water, which tends to be more stable than a blood sample and can be transported more easily.
The group's goal is to produce the device for under $30 a unit and to keep the cost of each test under a dollar. Andreas Sierra Davila from Guatemala says his project may pose an even more daunting cost challenge. That group is trying to design a low-cost incubator for infants, simple enough to be operated without the help of a neonatologist. The device also has to divide into a base and a top section that can be removed if a baby has to be transported to a hospital.
Well, we're trying to make it like under $100.
And what does a current one cost?
Well, they can go really, really high, maybe $15,000.
Solving those fundamental puzzles, how to reduce costs, build with locally available materials, address environmental concerns, is precisely the purpose here. Amy Smith, the MacArthur Genius Grant winner who organized the summit, says bringing in such a diverse group of people with an incredibly eclectic skill set yields astonishingly creative solutions. Of course, it also brings challenges.
You know, there's problems communicating, and so they have to try to figure out how to do that. You know, we have one team that has two Hondurans who don't speak English, two Zambians, one of whom is deaf, a Guatemalan and a Tibetan. And so, you know, it's a challenge for them to go through the process. When we were building sketch models, they had built a lot of little prototypes to share ideas with each other because of the fact that communication by words was so difficult. They communicated much better by objects. And so it was really interesting to see how the teams where there was more shared language, there seemed to be fewer prototypes built for idea generation, and where there was less shared language, there was more, you know, little physical artifacts. One of the things that I tell them is that, you know, the price you pay for diversity is frustration.
But those frustrations pale in comparison to the achievements. That sense of enormous possibility brought two of last year's Ghanaian participants back for a second summit. This time, as organizers. In fact, it's their goal to bring the entire IDDS summit to Ghana next summer. Program organizer Amy Smith says there would be many advantages in taking the program to Africa, paramount among them, the difficulty of getting visas for international participants.
A lot of our foreign participants are not people from wealthy backgrounds, and it's very difficult for them to get visas to come into this country. So we had about 10 people who were not able to be here because they weren't granted visas, which was very disappointing.
John Kwanzaa of the Nkrumah University in Ghana adds, with more than a hint of pride,
I believe Ghana has no problem with any country, so acquisition of visas will not be any problem.
But in the basement of 77 Mass Avenue in Cambridge, questions of visas are far from participants' minds. What matters now is getting projects finished, with only 2 weeks to go. The incubator group outlines a strategy. Here's Andreas Sierra Davila again.
Well, we're still doing some research to find the best materials that are going to be the best ones for this situation.
But teammate Aparna Ramanathan, a medical student, has some ideas.
Basically, we've decided to use electric power for the main heating component of the structure, but right now we're doing testing to figure out how to maintain heat in the bed part. So we're looking at phase change materials, simple hot water bottles, and a few other options for that. And then right now they're finalizing the design of the structure, and we hope to start building today or tomorrow.
If their determination is any indicator of potential success, they'll be finished with hours to spare. Maybe they'll even have time for lunch.
That's Here and Now's Karen Miller, Medicine at MIT's International Design and Development Seminar. To see some of the projects being developed, go to our website, here-now.org. Well, one of the greatest challenges facing developing countries is food. So today, the United Nations said it will provide more than $200 million in food assistance to help offset high food and oil prices. The aid will go to parts of Africa, Asia, and the Caribbean, with a particular focus on the Horn of Africa, where drought and political instability have exacerbated food shortages. The UN Food Agency says the aid will go to the most vulnerable people first, including pregnant women and malnourished children. The latest figures show nearly 1 billion people worldwide are struggling to get enough food. And before we go today, writing for adolescent boys, we revisit a conversation with the author of the Percy Jackson fantasy novels. You're listening to Here and Now. Chinese meteorologists are claiming success after last week's Olympic opening ceremonies. They fired off more than 1,000 rain dispersal rockets, and the rain held off. Now, it's debatable what exactly cleared the skies, but the technology used in Beijing is in testing around the world and here in the U.S., where an estimated 70% of businesses are affected by the weather. And for them, there's a new option designed to protect businesses against the vagaries of the weather. They're using an online service called WeatherBill. And joining us to talk about this is WeatherBill co-founder and CEO David Friedberg. Welcome.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for being with us. Can you explain how WeatherBill works exactly? We are in New England here, after all, where the saying goes, wait 5 minutes and the weather will change. So if I'm a resort owner on Cape Cod and I'm in the throes of this very wet summer where it's been raining every day, what might I have been able to do? Because I'm assuming I can't do it now, but what might I have been able to do to protect myself against the loss of business from all this rain?
So a resort in New England, let's just say they have a golf course. Every day it rains, they're going to shut down that golf course and lose $5,000 of revenue. They can buy coverage for the summer and say they want to get paid $5,000 every day it rains. And when it happens, we'll send them a check. And they pay a premium for the coverage up front, and they're covered for the whole summer.
Hmm. And what's the difference between what you do and insurance?
So our product actually pays out automatically based on whatever the weather event is that occurred. So when you buy your coverage, you choose a weather station that's close by to your business, and you say, I want the weather measured at this station. And then our computers are automatically looking at historical data, forecasts, and climate models for that particular location and figuring out what the probability looks like for payout. And so there's no proof of loss. There's no claims process. We automatically pay out if the specified weather occurs at that particular station.
And you pay out what, their estimated loss in revenue, or do they set the amount, the business set the amount?
You know, we don't necessarily have to come in and figure out your revenue and figure out your profits. You tell us the amount that you want coverage for, and then you choose the weather station that the measurement takes place at, and if it happens, we send you the check automatically.
I don't get it. How do you make any money?
Well, we just do a whole bunch of math and try and figure out what the probability is of the event that you want coverage for occurring, and we try and charge a little bit more. And over time, hopefully, the amount that we charge is higher than the total that we pay out.
Because of the volume of people who will be enrolled in your service.
That's right. And then we allow any business to customize the coverage to their needs. And so a golf course owner might want to protect against a rainy day, but a farmer might want to protect against a drought in the same area. And so sometimes we actually get the benefit of companies in the same area buying risks that cancel each other out.
And we should say this isn't just for inclement weather. Movie theaters can also say that a lot of sunshine is detrimental to their business because when it's nice out, people don't frequent movie theaters. Is that right?
That's right. We actually did a research report here a few months ago, and we found that when it's unusually warm or sunny outside, box office receipts go down by over 30%.
Do you determine also whether there is a direct relationship and how much of a relationship there is between a particular business and the weather?
We sure do. So businesses can send us a short summary of their financials. We will figure out how their business is impacted by the weather and how much. A car wash owner, for example, knows that he gets $0 of revenue any day that there's even the slightest bit of rain. An amusement park knows that attendance is down, but they don't know how many dollars they're losing for every inch of rain, for example. And so we can help them figure that thing out.
Who are some of your customers?
We've got a lot of customers in the agriculture industry. This year there was a big flood in Iowa and Illinois. And as a result, all the corn went into the ground really late in the season, and now it's sitting there through November, which is really unusual. And crop insurance doesn't cover you past September 30th. So all these corn farmers are knocking on our door for frost coverage this year.
Is it a little bit nerve-wracking to be betting on the weather almost in your case?
Well, that's what makes it fun. We get to keep a close eye more than I ever did on the weather reports as they come in. But our business is built over the long run, and so as we're seeing more and more clients come in, buying all sorts of different kinds of coverage. And we're actually able to make a good, sustainable, and profitable business out of this.
Well, David, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Yeah, thanks a lot. Appreciate the time.
That's David Friedberg. He's co-founder and CEO of the new online service, WeatherBill. In a minute, author Rick Riordan's series for young adults. That's next, here and now. If you know a preaching boy, you probably already have heard of Rick Riordan's series Percy Jackson and the Olympians. Percy is a troubled young man. He's dyslexic, has attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. He's been expelled from several schools. Oh, and he happens to be the son of a Greek god. Like the heroes of old, his heritage often brings him more trouble than good. For example, there's the beginning of Riordan's The Battle of the Labyrinth, which was published earlier this year. We asked 11-year-old Francis Corvino, who's a fan of the books, to read it for us.
Chapter 1, I Battle the Cheerleading Squad. The last thing I wanted to do on my summer break was blow up another school. But there I was, Monday morning, the first week of June, sitting in my mom's car in front of Good High School on East 81st Street. Good was this big brownstone building overlooking the East River. A bunch of BMWs and Lincoln Town Cars were parked out front, staring up at the fancy stone archway. I wondered how long it would take me to get kicked out of this place. Just relax. My mother didn't sound relaxed. It's only an orientation tour. And remember, dear, this is Paul's school, so try not to, you know, destroy it. Yes.
Of course, the cheerleaders turn out to be monsters. The school does get destroyed, and another Percy Jackson adventure begins. We spoke with Rick Riordan last year when the third book in this series, The Titan's Curse, was published, and we asked him about the world he creates in the Percy Jackson books.
This is basically the world of Greek mythology as it might exist today in 21st century America. Our hero here is Percy Jackson. He's a 12-year-old boy from New York. He believes his dad is dead in The Lightning Thief, the first book, but then he discovers that actually he's a demigod. His father is the Greek god Poseidon.
And in the book, Percy, the main character, goes to a camp to learn how to deal with his demigod status. Can you explain that?
Yeah, Camp Half-Blood is a place on Long Island where young heroes are trained under Chiron, the centaur trainer who trained all the heroes of old, including Hercules. And basically, the kids are divided into cabins depending on who their godly parent is. And even though that is where each book starts, most of the action of the books takes place on heroic quests. They have to go off into the world.
Why did you choose some of these old mythological characters to put in the books?
I've loved Greek myths since I was a kid, and I taught them when I was a middle school teacher for many years. But really, the impetus for the series was my own son. He was having a difficult year when he was in second grade. He had just been diagnosed with ADHD and dyslexia, and he didn't like reading. And for an English teacher like me, that was a pretty bitter pill to swallow. But he did like Greek mythology, and so I began to tell him some of the myths at home. And when I ran out, he said, "Well, Dad, tell me another one." I said, "Well, I don't have any." He said, "Well, why don't you make one up then?" And that's where Percy Jackson came from, a modern demigod who, like my son, is dyslexic and ADHD.
That was it's very interesting because Percy is dyslexic and has these attention problems. He's been expelled from school. He's not the perfect kid or the kid we read about in a lot of other, you know, that are the main characters in a lot of other children's novels. So what kind of feedback do you get from that? And why do the book like that? Because you were inspired by your son? Or?
Well, I really wasn't conscious that I was doing this, but I think I was using mythology as it always has been used to explain things through allegory that are otherwise unexplainable. I was trying to help my son sort of make sense of what was going on with him, that he had these learning differences and it was making life difficult for him. And to turn it into a myth where Percy finds out that actually these learning conditions are a sign in my world that you might be very special indeed. You might have Olympian blood. Well, my son just loved that. He thought that was great. And the feedback that I've gotten from parents, from teachers, from kids has just been phenomenal. I've had parents tell me that the Percy Jackson series is the first thing that their dyslexic children have ever read, have ever enjoyed. I had an email from a parent the other day that said she came in and found her son reading, and it just shocked her because he had never read a book, and he was working his way through the Percy Jackson books.
And so you think it's that sense of maybe not being perfect that's what appeals maybe to kids?
Well, certainly that is true of the Greek heroes. They are definitely not perfect, and so are the Greek gods. They're very flawed, but that's what makes them so interesting.
I wonder, though, if there are some folks who maybe might think that it's not good role model for kids. I'm sure there are people who say your hero in the book gets expelled from school. He thinks a lot of things about academics are boring. And then the Greek gods themselves, who obviously have all sorts of flaws that you bring up in the book. I mean, are there people who say that to you?
I don't get that very much, actually. I'm sure that there are some people who say that, but I think a perfect world just isn't realistic, and it certainly wouldn't be very much fun to read about.
What about what happens next for Percy? How many do you think will be in this series?
Right. It will be a book series of five. Number five will wrap up Percy's story. I may end up doing other stories about Camp Half-Blood and other characters. I'm not sure yet, but five, I think, will cover the story arc for Percy himself.
So you already know what's going to happen to Percy.
I know the big picture. I know how it will end. I know the major plot details, but the minor things, the specifics, sort of surprise me every time I'm writing a book, and that's what makes it fun for me to keep going.
Mm-hmm. Now, you're also doing another series book at the same time?
I am. I actually started being a middle school teacher and writing adult mystery novels, and I did that for about 7 years before it finally occurred to me that maybe I really should be writing for kids. My students had been telling me that for years. Mr. Riordan, why aren't you writing for us? But it took me a long time to get to that point, and I am still doing the adult mysteries as well.
So what do you think when you look at the popularity of a lot of series books right now? There's obviously the Harry Potter series, there's the Lemony Snicket series, there's a lot of children's series books right now. Is it hard to sort of distinguish yourself?
You know, I think it's fabulous how much great children's literature there is. As a teacher for many years, I had a hard time finding enough good books to make a reading list. I'm not too worried about distinguishing myself from the other authors. I think that the kids have really responded very well to the books, and my sense of humor is a little bit different, and my fantasy world is a little bit different than maybe the other series. But kids will read if you give them books that they'll enjoy.
Even kids who reading may come very, you know, hard too. They'll read as well?
Absolutely. You know, I was a reluctant reader when I was in school, and yet I became an English teacher after all of that. But it took me a long time to discover that reading could actually be fun. I had to find the right kind of book for me. So I have a lot of sympathy for reluctant readers, and I definitely try to make these books that will appeal not only to the kids that would pick them up anyway, but to the kids who maybe have never read a book.
And of course, I think the big question is, does your son like them, right? I mean, they started out as stories to him. Does he like them?
That is absolutely the case. And really, it has always been about my own sons. I actually have two boys, and they're 12 and 9, and they are always my first critics. They read the books before anyone else does, and we read them together. We sit in the bed, and I sit in the middle of them, and I read it aloud, the entire manuscript. And if it doesn't work for them, then I don't even bother sending it to my editor. It's got to be revised until it works for middle grade boys, specifically mine.
That's author Rick Riordan. The fourth book in his Percy Jackson series, The Battle of the Labyrinth, is now in bookstores. One of the mythological characters Riordan puts in the book is the nymph Calypso, who in Homer's Odyssey rescued the Greek hero Odysseus when he was shipwrecked on her island. We leave you with another modern take on her story.
My name is Calypso. I have let him go. In the dawn he sails away to be gone forevermore, and the waves will take him in again, but he'll know their ways now. I will stand upon the shore with a clean heart and my song in the wind. The sand may sting my feet and the sky will burn. It's a lonely time. Do not ask him to return.
That's Calypso by Suzanne Vega. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Please join us again, Here and Now,